Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It is Tuesday, June 30th, 2026, and you are joining us for our Commodities and Energy edition.
Today's thesis centers on the structural physical constraints emerging within the digital transition. We are seeing a fundamental shift where the primary limit on computational scaling is no longer just algorithmic efficiency, but the hard reality of energy-intensive infrastructure.
So the bottleneck has moved from the software layer to the power grid.
Exactly.
We begin by examining the power bottleneck. Can the global grid actually handle the unprecedented surge of the AI boom? Microsoft and Chevron just inked a 20-year power purchase agreement in West Texas, and it's not about software. We are talking about a massive, physical, and incredibly expensive scramble for the literal plugs that keep the lights on in the digital age. Today, we're looking at the power bottleneck. Can the global grid actually handle the AI boom?
It's the defining commodity trade of the decade, Maya. The bottleneck has moved through the supply chain like a wave. First, it was GPUs, then it was high-bandwidth memory, and now, as Momo Koo observed on Bloomberg Surveillance, it has landed squarely on power infrastructure.
So the cloud isn't actually some ethereal, weightless thing floating above us, but rather a series of heavy, thirsty, industrial furnaces.
There's a signal here. We are seeing a fundamental shift from the era of software intelligence to the era of infrastructure sovereignty. As Redefining Energy pointed out, the current AI capital expenditure cycle is projected to reach 9% of global GDP. That's larger than the peak of the 1880s railroad boom. This isn't just an upgrade, it's a complete reconfiguration of the physical world.
9% of global GDP. I think I need to sit down. That's a lot of transformers.
It's massive. And the scale of the individual projects is what's truly breaking the old models. We used to talk about 50 megawatt data center parcels. Now, as Eugene McGrain of Cushman Wakefield noted, the baseline requirement has jumped to 500 megawatt or even 1 gigawatt developments. These are massive single-site developments that require 15-year power purchase agreements just to prove they can exist.
And I'm assuming the local utility companies aren't exactly lining up with pens ready to sign these off.
They can't. The queues are crippling. In the UK, we're seeing a clustering problem where data center demand exploded from 4 gigawatts in late 2024 to 125 gigawatts by June 2025. In West London, these facilities are consuming 18% of local demand, effectively stalling new housing projects. It's a zero-sum game for the grid.
The choice is basically, do you want a high-speed LLM or do you want an apartment for a human being?
That's the tension. And even the regulators are trying to intervene. According to a report by Sightline Climate, the UK's Ofgem implemented a first-ready, first-served model in April 2025 to prune speculative projects. They're looking at a massive 125 gigawatt demand queue, but only seeing about 4.5 gigawatts of viable connections available for 2030.
Which sounds like a polite way of saying the system is fundamentally broken.
It's why the strategy is shifting behind the meter. If you can't wait 10 years for a grid connection, you build your own power source. The Microsoft Chevron deal in West Texas is a high-quality proof point for this. They are using natural gas as a foundational immediate bridge. As some analysts have argued, advanced nuclear solutions are great, but they take a decade to implement. Natural gas can scale now.
I love the optimism of just burn some gas to power the robots, but isn't there a massive friction point with the flexible nature of modern grids?
That's the incongruity problem. As noted in Argus Media, there is a fundamental clash between modern grid management, which relies on flexible loads that can ramp up or down to stabilize the system, and AI data centers, which require 100% uptime. You can't ask an AI factory to power down just because the wind stopped blowing. This is driving developers toward private wire or even off-grid solutions to decouple from grid volatility entirely.
We're essentially seeing the rise of digital islands.
The pattern is clear. It's changing the architecture of the buildings themselves. Redefining Energy highlighted that we are moving from a real estate-first approach to an IT-first approach. We used to build a warehouse and then put servers in it. Now, because rack densities are jumping from 15 kilowatts to over 115 kilowatts, the power and cooling requirements dictate the entire blueprint. We are talking about AI factories that look more like heavy industrial plants than office buildings.
Which brings us to the cooling. If these things are essentially massive radiators, the water and electricity usage must be astronomical.
It's already causing a political backlash. Paul Chapman of HC Group mentioned the rising resentment in rural areas regarding the parasitic consumption of local water and power by data centers that offer relatively low long-term employment. To combat this, companies like Lenovo are positioning themselves as orchestrators, managing the entire stack from liquid-cooled server clusters to the edge. The goal is to move toward a bring-your-own-power model that utilizes advanced load management to mitigate that very public backlash.
It's funny. We spent years worrying about the intelligence of the models, and now we're just worried about whether there's enough copper and gas to keep them from overheating.
It's the ultimate commoditization. The intelligence of the LLM is becoming a commodity, but the ability to secure land, transformers, and cheap renewable energy is the new moat. This is why we see regions like the Middle East emerging as vital hubs due to low-cost solar. It's not about who has the best code, it's about who has the cheapest, most reliable electrons.
And the supply chain for the hardware isn't helping either. Winston Cheng from Lenovo suggested that the bottlenecks for things like transformers and memory-related components will likely persist for at least another 2 to 3 years, because you can't just software patch a new semiconductor fab or a massive power transformer into existence.
There's also a massive labor shortage. We aren't just talking about software engineers. We need electricians, plumbers, and specialized construction workers capable of building these ultra-dense environments. If you can't find the people to wire the building, the capital doesn't matter.
It's a massive, expensive physical game of Tetris.
And the stakes are high. As noted by the Columbia Energy Exchange, the U.S. tech capital spending boom is so large that it's being compared to the combined scale of the moon landing, the Manhattan Project, and the electrification of American farms. This isn't just a sector trend, it's a structural shift in the U.S. and global economy.
Even the Trump administration's tariff policies seem to be bowing to this reality. There's evidence that 80 to 85% of A-related items have been specifically exempted from recent tariff schedules to avoid choking off this primary engine of U.S. capital expenditure. You can't have a trade war with your own power supply.
It's the technological immunity strategy. The policy reflects the realization that if you tax the transformers, you're essentially taxing the future of U.S. economic growth.
The developers in West Texas and the engineers in Malaysia are now the ones holding the cards.
They are. The winners won't be the ones with the cleverest prompts, but the ones who can guarantee 15-year power stability in a world of rising energy volatility.
Utilities and hyperscalers need to accelerate their private wire and off-grid investments immediately to avoid total grid paralysis.
Keep a close eye on the next round of major natural gas PPA announcements in the U.S. They will be the clearest signal of whether the bridge fuel strategy can actually keep pace with the demand.
But as the cost of power surges, it leads us to a much more systemic anxiety. How much more pressure can the global credit markets take before the cost of all this massive debt starts to crack the foundation? I was reading through the latest credit projections this morning, and apparently the U.S. government is essentially running a massive, high-stakes party where the national defense budget has officially been eclipsed by the cost of simply paying interest on our existing debt.
It's hard to ignore that shift, Maya, especially when you look at the fiscal plumbing. We're seeing a 6% GDP deficit even during an economic expansion, which creates this massive structural pressure on the entire global credit market.
We're effectively subsidizing our own interest payments with a deficit that would make a payday lender blush. Is this why everyone is suddenly so obsessed with the Federal Reserve's next move on interest rates?
The data tells a story. The debate over whether the Fed is actually in control is getting heated. Aditya Bave suggests the Fed might actually need 3 additional rate hikes to combat supply-side inflation, which is currently sitting 60 basis points higher than it was this time last year. He argues that current policy is essentially offside because, despite a 75 basis point easing relative to last year, unemployment hasn't budged and core PCE remains stubbornly high.
So the Fed is essentially trying to catch a speeding train by looking in the rearview mirror.
That's one way to put it. But there's a strategic pivot happening. Bave suggests Chairman Warsh has a window of operating opportunity to hike rates now and frame those increases as a necessary response to inflation patterns established under the previous administration. It's a way to pivot the blame.
Very clever. It's not my inflation, it's the legacy inflation. But if they keep hiking, doesn't that eventually make the whole credit structure snap?
That is the trillion-dollar question. Sharma has been quite vocal about this, warning that while a 150 to 200 basis point hike is the historical catalyst for bursting bubbles, even a 50 basis point increase could destabilize the current system due to the sheer volume of debt embedded globally. The real danger isn't just the rate itself, but an unanchored long-end bond market if the Fed fails to respond to rising inflation. Sharma even points to a 5% yield on 10-year U.S. Treasuries as the bell that signals the end of the current bubble.
So we're all just waiting for a specific number to appear on a screen so we can all collectively panic.
Well, it's more nuanced than just panic. There's a divergence in how this hits different markets. On Bloomberg Surveillance, Sam Gyer warned that while U.S. defaults are historically low, the combination of high issuance levels and a deteriorating jobs market could drive high-yield spreads toward 300 basis points in the second half of 2026. It's a mechanism where high leverage and declining interest coverage eventually catch up to the stability of the credit cycle.
But wait, if the U.S. economy is supposedly robust, as the analysts say, doesn't that provide some cushion for the energy and commodity sectors?
It does, but it's a double-edged sword. We are seeing a new nominal GDP regime with 6.1% growth. While that puts upward pressure on yields, it also increases the cash flows available for companies to service debt, which helps lower default risks. However, the pricing in the market is currently, let's call it, erratic. The SOFR curve contains a significant pricing anomaly, where the market is forecasting 3 rate hikes through early 2027, followed immediately by an aggressive 50 basis point cut.
A sudden massive rate cut right after a hiking cycle. That sounds less like a policy plan and more like a way to induce a heart attack in the bond market.
It is fundamentally inconsistent with standard economic cycles. Ira Jersey argues that the market is likely mispricing the speed of these movements and that the Fed committee drives the market rather than being controlled by it. There's also a counterargument from Brent Donnelly, who suggests the new Fed chair's hawkishness might be purely performative. He notes that data regarding oil, GDP, and unemployment doesn't necessarily justify the aggressive hikes the market is pricing in. In fact, falling oil prices towards $70 per barrel could provide enough disinflationary momentum to reduce the need for that aggressive cycle.
So if oil goes down, the Fed might back off, but if they back off, the unanchored bond market might blow up. It's a lovely circular way to stay stressed.
It gets even more complex when you look globally. In Asia, we're seeing extreme compression in dollar investment grade spreads, which are tighter than their US counterparts. It's a precarious break-even environment, where a mere 11 basis point widening would wipe out all excess returns for the second half of 2026. If you want resilience, the play seems to be high-yield credit in Asia, because its short duration and yields over 7% provide a buffer against the inevitable spread widening caused by emerging stagflation.
It sounds like the only way to survive this is to hide in the most complicated short-duration corner of the world and hope the US doesn't decide to hike another 50 basis points on a whim.
It's certainly a game of managing volatility rather than predicting direction. Even in the equity space, the risk is highly concentrated. Bloomberg Surveillance noted that the AI investment cycle has transitioned into a systemic financial risk. The $800 billion in capex from just 5 hyperscalers is essentially funding the earnings of 60 other companies, creating a single massive vulnerability across US equities and even the bond market.
One bad earnings report from a cloud provider could trigger a domino effect that brings down the entire global credit market.
That is the concentrated correlation we're watching.
Energy traders should start looking at those debt servicing costs as a primary driver of long-term inflation. Keep a close eye on the 10-year Treasury yield to see if it starts creeping toward that 5% threshold. But if the cost of money is this unpredictable, I wonder how it's going to impact the physical movement of goods through the world's most crowded shipping lanes. I was at a gas station yesterday and the price on the pump hadn't budged in a week, despite every headline suggesting the Middle East is essentially a giant, unexploded grenade.
That's because the global market has been performing a masterclass in nonlinear stabilization. We saw a massive supply shock, the loss of 13 million barrels of production per day during the recent Strait of Hormuz closure, and yet Brent crude didn't hit the $200 mark everyone was bracing for.
Right, because supply shock is often just a polite way of saying everyone panicked, but then China decided to stop buying stuff.
We can trace that further on Bloomberg Surveillance. Analysts noted that China's massive reduction in crude imports, falling by over 5 million barrels per day through June 2026, effectively acted as a global stabilizer. By absorbing that extra supply that would have otherwise flooded the market, they essentially neutralized the price spike.
China is essentially playing the role of the world's voluntary economic brake. Is this some brilliant strategic move or just a lucky coincidence?
It might be more intentional than we think. There's this altruistic neighbor theory emerging that Beijing is suppressing its own demand to prevent an economic collapse of regional partners like South Korea. It's a way to position itself as a regional leader, while the US pivots its military assets away from Asia toward the Middle East.
A grand strategy where China keeps the lights on in Asia in exchange for a little less US pressure in the Pacific. That sounds less like diplomacy and more like a high-stakes poker game.
It's definitely a shift in how we define energy security. As S&P Global's Calvin Lee emphasized, security is increasingly defined by the logistics of physical delivery and the vulnerability of choke points, rather than just total production capacity. You can have all the oil in the world, but if the Strait of Hormuz is blocked, that oil is useless.
And Iran seems to have figured out how to use that uselessness as a weapon.
It's a telling detail. Bloomberg Surveillance warned that Iran is successfully using the Strait to exert economic pressure on the US, and this provides a blueprint for other nations. Think about Indonesia and the Strait of Malacca. They could use similar geographic leverage to demand massive economic concessions or even tolls from the international community.
Great, so we're moving toward a world where shipping lanes are basically just a series of toll booths owned by whoever has the best geography.
It makes the market incredibly brittle. We're seeing a massive decoupling of paper prices from physical reality. Professional traders experienced this during the March-April period, where algorithmic trading based on headlines failed to account for actual tanker positioning and war risk insurance premiums. In fact, some models were signaling raging buys based on fair value, but because the physical reality was so volatile, risk management limits were throttled down by 90%. Everyone was bullish, but no one was actually buying.
So the paper market is essentially hallucinating while the real tankers are just stuck in traffic.
And that's the real danger. While we're seeing a stockpile release effect where 100 million barrels of trapped oil are finally exiting the strait, the underlying structure is weak. Argus Media noted that the relief from the US-Iran MOU might be premature because the IEA's projected paper surplus is undermined by a massive 1.1 billion barrel global stock draw happening between now and September.
Which brings us to the looming deadline.
The expiration of the current US-Iran MOU in August is the immediate threat. There is a fundamental deadlock regarding Iran's intention to charge navigation fees in the strait. Once the 60-day ceasefire expires in late August 2026, that tension could reignite a major conflict.
Even the unfreezing of those billions in Iranian assets via Qatar, as Amos Hochstein warned, could act as a catalyst for regional instability.
If we see prices drift toward that $56 to $60 level we saw last December, a $5 to $10 risk premium will likely snap back onto Brent and WTI almost instantly.
Negotiators in Washington need to realize that the current maritime stability is built on a very thin layer of frozen assets and temporary agreements.
Watch the shipping insurance premiums out of the Persian Gulf in late August. If they spike, the era of cheap, predictable energy transit is officially in the rearview mirror.
But all of this volatility in the physical world makes you wonder how much the new race for computing power and silicon sovereignty will rely on these same fragile trade routes.
15-1.
That is the supply-demand imbalance we're seeing in the semiconductor market right now, a ratio so skewed it's essentially a high-stakes game of musical chairs where the music only stops when someone loses a fortune.
It's the foundation of the new AI arms race, Maya. We are moving away from the era of just building massive models to battle over the commodities that power them, silicon, software, and the energy to run it all.
It sounds less like a tech revolution and potentially more like a frantic scramble for the last remaining seats at a crowded buffet. But this isn't just about having the biggest GPU cluster, it's about what those chips actually do once they're plugged in.
Something to flag here on Bloomberg surveillance. Analysts noted that the focus is shifting from massive pre-training to inference and completion. The real value is moving to how models execute real-world tasks. We're seeing a pivot toward the application layer, where the goal isn't just raw parameter size, but the efficiency of task execution.
We're moving from look how much this brain knows to look how much this brain actually gets done.
Two things stand out. In fact, the metric for success is changing. We're seeing a shift from daily active users to what Beidou CFO Henry he calls daily active agents, or DAA. It's no longer about how many humans click a button, but how many autonomous agents are completing complex, multi-step workflows without human intervention.
I love the idea of an agent doing my taxes, but I suspect the cost of these agents is about to hit a very volatile commodity market of its own.
It is.
Odlots highlighted that the unit cost of AI tokens is collapsing so rapidly, potentially by half within a few weeks, that companies can't even use fixed budgets anymore. They have to manage a volatile package of speed, cost, and output efficiency. This is driving a massive shift in the corporate sales cycle. Decision makers are moving from CTOs, who see software as a cost center, to CEOs, who see these agents as direct drivers of profit.
It's like moving from buying a printer, which is just an expensive desk ornament, to hiring a full-time clerk who only gets paid if they actually finish the paperwork.
That's the result-driven payment model emerging in the ecosystem. But while the US focuses on the software, China is building a massive, vertically integrated hardware-to-cloud pipeline. Beidou, for instance, is targeting that 80% of incremental token demand driven by inference by integrating their proprietary TPU chips directly into their cloud infrastructure. They are even preparing to spin off their chip assets in Hong Kong to create a more neutral ecosystem for third-party developers.
It's a massive supply chain squeeze. And if you think the hardware layer is stable, remember that Mexico's emergence as a top tech exporter to the US creates a massive vulnerability. Any trade dispute over transshipment of Chinese components could instantly paralyze US domestic capex.
Between the persistent memory shortages that have tripled component prices and the intense involution or cutthroat competition in China, the entire stack is under pressure.
Investors need to stop looking at model size and start auditing the efficiency of the underlying compute. Keep an eye on those chip spin-offs in Hong Kong, because if the hardware decouples from the cloud, the entire competitive landscape for inference changes. But if the software is getting this efficient, where is all that massive power consumption actually going to come from? Everyone is obsessed with the peak oil apocalypse, but looking at the sheer scale of the current energy transition, it feels like we're just swapping one volatile commodity for another. Between the massive push for nuclear and the scramble for renewables, isn't the whole energy security argument just a way to mask a massive, expensive gamble on unproven infrastructure?
It's not a gamble so much as a structural reconfiguration. We aren't just swapping fuels, we're seeing a decoupling of supply chains. Take the US shale revolution, it's fundamentally altering the NGL landscape. Doomerg argued that the peak oil narrative is structurally flawed because it ignores the massive US shale-driven expansion toward 8 million barrels per day of NGL production.
We're not running out of oil, we're just drowning in side products.
Worth noting, we're seeing an influx of propane and butane that is actually creating an artificial valuation gap. Because the global industrial infrastructure lacks the immediate engine capacity to convert this sudden influx of embodied energy into work, these NGLs are often priced lower than crude on an energy content basis. It's a just-in-time evolution of the market, driven by demand in places like India, where the shift from kerosene to LPG is a massive tailwind for US exports.
Just-in-time evolution? That sounds like a very polite way of saying we're building the plane while it's in a tailspin. And what about the nuclear piece? Is that just the next big way to blow a hole in the balance sheet?
The economics are definitely lopsided. While the US Department of Energy is attempting to de-risk the sector by front-loading capital to cover roughly 20% of total project costs, up to $1.75 billion per reactor, to secure long lead items like pressure vessels, they are fighting a massive cost disparity. As Michael Sembalist noted, construction in China, India, and Korea is estimated at only 20 to 25% of the cost of major Western projects.
The West is paying a 400% premium for the privilege of extra paperwork and litigation.
It's less about technological superiority and more about structural regulatory hurdles.
Investors in the US power utility space need to recalibrate their long-term CapEx assumptions for domestic nuclear. Keep a close eye on the next round of DOE loan guarantees to see if that 20% capital front-loading actually prevents cost overruns on new small modular reactors. As we wrap up this edition, the thread connecting everything we've discussed today, from the massive Chevron-Microsoft power deal to the widening US deficit, is the collision between digital ambition and physical reality. We are witnessing the moment where the expansion of intelligence hits the hard ceiling of the energy grid. The era of scaling through software alone has ended. The new frontier is defined by the sheer capacity to move electrons, secure transformers, and manage the massive thermal load of a gigawatt-scale data center.
The single most important implication here is that the strategic advantage is shifting away from the developers of the models and toward the owners of the upstream supply chain. For a player like the US Department of Energy or even large-scale utilities, the primary calculus is no longer about optimizing for data throughput, but about managing a massive, permanent surge in baseload demand that threatens to crowd out residential stability and destabilize the grid. The moat for the next decade isn't just better code. It is the ability to guarantee a continuous, high-density power supply in an increasingly supply-constrained world.
It all comes down to whether we can build the physical foundations fast enough to support the digital superstructure without triggering a systemic inflationary shock or a total breakdown in credit markets.
To see if this tension is reaching a breaking point, keep a very close eye on the Strait of Hormuz as we approach the end of August. Any sign of renewed maritime friction or a spike in Persian Gulf insurance premiums will be the immediate signal that the energy volatility we're seeing in the paper markets is about to become a very real, very expensive physical reality for the global economy.
Thanks for joining us this Tuesday. We'll see you next week.